Hello and welcome to the Squawker Talker podcast. My name is Sam Long, filling in as host this week, and I'm delighted to be joined by Squawker chief writer Mohammed Butt. How are you, Mo?
I'm feeling good. Lots of football this weekend, lots to talk about.
Absolutely. And also here is Squawker editor Will Hall. How are you doing, Will?
Yeah. When you consider it's supposedly the most depressing day of the year, I'm not too bad.
Here's a tip that we got from one of our office members. If you have the McDonald's app or download the McDonald's app, you can go to McDonald's and get a free cheeseburger. So there you go. For today only.
That's pretty appetizing.
I mean, we don't actually have a commercial deal with McDonald's.
We should do. Hey, McDonald's, give us a call. We're loving it.
Okay, we've got loads to get through this week, so let's jump right in and kick off with our review of the Premier League games. First up is the number one, which is the total number of shots on target Arsenal faced against Chelsea on Saturday, which is the joint fewest of any Big Six side in a Premier League game this season and the lowest under Maurizio Sarri. Arsenal really needed a win. The tide looked like it was turning against Unai Emery. So are we putting this one down as a tactical victory for him?
Oh, absolutely, 100%. He set his side out in the diamond formation, which we've been noted actually on Squawker that it's like this is becoming a big thing in the Big Six, like using the diamond to affect matches. Obviously, United did it to Spurs last week. No, it was brilliant. He diagnosed Chelsea's weaknesses. It's not just Jorginho. Obviously, everyone and their mothers forget that if you press Jorginho, you shut them down. But also because he split his fullbacks, why? Because it was the diamond. Lacazette and Aubameyang could also press the centre-backs. So it wasn't just that they were stopping Jorginho getting the ball. They were stopping David Luiz, who's very important to Chelsea, really he did it occasionally, but really playing out with the same sort of efficiency that he normally does. And what that did was that just completely isolated the Chelsea forward. So Eden Hazard is phenomenal and does routinely humiliate Arsenal, but he couldn't get the ball. The ball was not getting to him in any sort of useful area.
It was a false nine again, wasn't it?
I mean, even if he was playing on the left, though, it wouldn't have made a difference because the way that Arsenal set up was specifically to deny him the ball. Like, not even just deny him the ball as the false nine, just deny him the ball altogether. And it really worked. They really played well. That's the best way to beat Chelsea. There's two things you do. Obviously, you press Jorginho, you press David Luiz, and then you keep the ball from Hazard. So they made sure that they did that. Sokratis had a very good game, and that's the other thing you have to say about Arsenal. A tactical victory, yes, but they also had one of Sokratis' good days. Like, he can have bad days. Like, on another day, they could have played that game exactly the same way, and he would have done something stupid and given away a goal. That's the problem with him, but he played well. Bellerin was sensational until his injury. That was a really hope. I mean, it was so heartbreaking to see him go down like that because he was phenomenal. I think had he not had to go off, I think Arsenal would have won by more. I think, and this is the one thing now I'm worried about Arsenal looking forward is that system, the diamond, relies so much on Bellerin and Kolasinac. And without Bellerin, I don't know that they can do it that effectively. Like, unless they put Maitland-Niles there and he plays brilliantly, but even then, he's not Hector Bellerin, so I don't know. But yeah, tactically, he's still, this is what we said at the start of the season, it's still a work in progress. And Unai Emery exposed that.
Yeah. Well, Sarri certainly wasn't happy after the game.
Oh my God.
absolutely. Tore his players a new one. What do you think, Will? Did he go in a bit too hard on them?
The content of his criticism is bad enough in that he is criticising the players like innately. It's a personal attack by saying they are difficult to motivate. It's like it's their mindset, it's who they are, rather than just criticising the performance. Like saying on this occasion, they were their determination was like his buzzword that wasn't there. There's also the sense of ceremony that he created around it by coming into his press conference, and I think he also did the same in his interview with Match of the Day, which was, so he said, I'm going to conduct this press conference in Italian, whereas he usually does his press conferences in English with a translator, because I want my message to be really clear.
You knew it was going to be fireworks because, really then, didn't you?
Yeah, well, exactly. And as a player, I imagine you can take public criticism on the chin a little bit more by telling yourself that the manager allowed his emotions to get the better of him. He was angry immediately after the game. But what Sarri did by how he framed the criticism he was about to go into was just, I mean, there's no chance of being able to tell yourself it was emotion getting the better of him because it was just so abundantly clear that what his criticism was premeditated. He had
this is the thing though. I think if you look at it, it. And because, I mean, they were saying it in the studio afterwards that Rio Ferdinand said he was talking to David Luiz, and there was no hint that David Luiz was unhappy with Sarri or that Sarri was a problem. And I think this very specifically was aimed at one or two players. Namely just Eden Hazard, I think. Very, very clearly.
It has
clearly.
To be more than one or two, though, because he says this team is...
No, but that's the point, though, isn't it?
He says this team is never going to be known for its battling qualities or something like
this
that.
But this is the thing, though. If he comes out and says Eden Hazard is a waste man, then he's going to be in big trouble. Like
he's also, like, drawing from the playbook of, like, the third manager to get sacked this season, Jose Mourinho, being really inventive with his public... the way he criticises players.
It was, but at the same time, if you think about it, this is... I would never think a manager should really criticize their players in public. I think it's a bad look, and I think it doesn't help you in any way, I wouldn't have imagined. But I understand his frustrations to a degree, because Chelsea are notoriously fussy in terms of a club. The players there don't like learning new things. Sometimes they'll take to something. So for example, they took the Conte's formation very well and they won 13 games in a row. But you know what, if they had lost a couple of those games, they probably would have revolted against that. And in the end they did revolt against Conte. They were like, oh, we don't like you, you're bored of you now, get out of here. And Sarri has been obviously very, very famously demanding coach tactically, what he wants from his players. He doesn't give them anything easy to do. But I think it's you know, this has been boiling for a while, I think, because you can see the way that Chelsea move the ball. Hazard is, and you talk to Chelsea fans about this, they'll all say, tell you the same thing. Hazard is great when he wants it. When he's on it, he's phenomenal. But there are so many games where he just coasts through it, thinking that his talent will just see him through. And I think that's why I think Sarri was aiming particularly at Hazard, because there are too many games, and I've been a big critic of Hazard before the season for that very reason. There are too many games where he just sort of walks through it, thinking, I can just win this in my sleep. And you can't really in the Premier League these days, and more to the point, when you're playing in a tactical system like a Chelsea's, like Sarri's, where everyone has to be on it every game, you can't. You know, but and
I think that's why the point that Sarri's trying to get across is that maybe Chelsea 2 or 3 weeks ago looked at the league and thought, we're pretty much nailed on for a top four finish here, we can maybe sort of take it easy.
Yeah.
And now they definitely can't. That's a big defeat to Arsenal. And now it's looking like it's going to be very tight for that final place.
One of the big things you have to have as a systems coach, right, is you have to have courage in your convictions. So when things start going wrong, you have to keep doing what you're doing. Like there's a famous example, the Clasico game where Victor Valdes made a horrific mistake against Real Madrid. Like, he gave the ball away and Real Madrid scored after like 20 seconds or something. And Pep Guardiola was like, no, after that mistake, we didn't have a go at Valdes. We kept passing it back to him anyway. We were like, keep passing the ball. And eventually Barca won the game 3-1. They dominated the game. It was back in 2011, December 2011, I think. So, and Guardiola said after the game, look, we trust Valdes implicitly. Like, we were always, and that was just a microcosm of the fact that they knew what they were doing. They had full conviction of their beliefs. And that's the ultimate, what you have to have as a systems coach is belief. Like, half of the time, what makes Guardiola's side so good, what made his Barca side and his Bayern side so good, and what City are trying to get to, is you can't scare them into playing something some other way of football. You couldn't, like, when you come at them and you'd press them, they'd be like, yeah, all right, have your fun. And then they'd carry on playing their football. They wouldn't get intimidated out of the way. And that's what Sarri wants from his... That's what his Napoli side had. You couldn't intimidate his Napoli side. They played Man City. They played Man City the same way they played Benevento, you know, last season when you know, and he wasn't afraid, because he knew that having courage of your convictions is what's going to make your team great. And that was... That's missing from this Chelsea side. It's evidently missing. When you press them a little bit, they wilt. They don't fight. And I think that's what he means by fighting, more so than lunging into tackles and everything. It's having the courage of your convictions to stick by what you're doing. Jorginho is now looking a bit aimless, because everyone in midfield, and he's guilty of it himself. I'm not saying he's innocent, but everyone in midfield, when the going gets tough, they don't stick to what they're being told, the tactical roles they're meant to play. They get very timid, very... gentle, very, you know, they're laid back. They think, okay, they panic and they go into sort of default modes. And Hazard is obviously the king of that stuff. This is what I've always been. I really was hoping this season would be the season where the penny drops and he becomes the world class, world dominating, world conquering talent. He should be. He is. He's the phenomenal ability. But it's the same thing with him. He started the season hot. Everyone's like, yeah, this is it. 40 goals, nailed on. I was one of the people that got sucked into it, unfortunately. Myself and Jake Hintwitz were like, yeah, 40 goals, here we go. And then and then typical Hazard, he's just, you know, typical Hazard is just eased off now and he's coasting through games as per usual, talking about Real Madrid. You know, Chelsea should have sold him this summer. He's an absolute mercenary. He's not interested in anything but Chelsea.
Ouch.
He's only interested in himself. And it's abundantly clear this season. The second he started playing well, it's, oh, I might go to Real Madrid this year in the summer. Ooh. You know,
he made the noises about wanting to become a Chelsea legend as well, didn't he?
Yeah, but then as soon as it was like, he was becoming well, it's like, oh, I might go to Real Madrid though. You never know.
He likes to flip flop. He'll come out one week and say and make a comment heavily suggesting he's staying at Chelsea, and then the next week do the same but go to Real Madrid.
I don't want to pin it all on Hazard. It's not like he's Satan or anything, but he's endemic. He's like the ultimate example of the problem Chelsea have, where I think they don't have courage of their convictions and they revert way too easily to their usual baseline stuff when they need to actually keep playing. Keep believing in Sadismo, because that is ultimately the way they will prosper. You know, what's that quote? We don't want to play well because we win. We're going to play well, and through that, we'll win games. I think Guardiola said that in Graham Hunter's documentary. But basically, that's it. That's honestly what it is. Stick to what Sadi tells you, you'll win games. Look at his Napoli side. They were outgunned by multiple sides in Serie A, competed anyway.
Well, he's definitely going to live and die by his system, isn't he, Sarri? But he's sort of setting himself up for a fall, really, if it doesn't work, especially if he gets the transfers in that he wants. So moving on, next up we've got the number three. Crystal Palace failed to pick up any points, but became the first team to score three times at Anfield since Liverpool beat Manchester City 4-3 in mid-January of last year. So a rare case of Liverpool failing to take control on home turf, Will?
Yeah, it boils down to the MacArthur moment where he kind of suckered Firmino and Keita. I think Sadio Mane ran the width of the pitch to press him. Mm. I don't know if he was doing it inadvertently, but the result was they managed to create a situation where Wilfried Zaha was one-on-one with James Milner, which was the name of the game for Palace.
Absolutely, yeah.
And through that, he cuts it back. Townsend scores. So yeah, he's basically he suckered Liverpool back into 2017-2018 mode, and that is symbolic of how throughout the game maybe they did abandon their sort of the principles that have served them quite well this season in how they've been controlling games. Another first was that I've not seen Van Dijk blocked like that on a set piece for the Tompkins game. I think Ayew steps in front of him and basically holds him in place. Mm. First time I've seen him not fall for one of those tricks, but just be taken out for a sort of set piece routine.
Yeah,
and that obviously made it 2-2. I think Hodgson's got a point in saying that they were unfortunate through Liverpool's two goals, which both came through deflections, and it wasn't a great performance. It was chaos basically.
Yeah.
Klopp's reaction at full time by sort of identifying relief as the primary emotion he was feeling sums it all up, really.
Yeah, I mean, a difficult one to analyse for Palace as well.
I would say one thing is that the goal that the opener Palace scored was not really a counter attack per se, and I think there's almost a dismissiveness when you talk about the way Palace players are a counter attacking team just because they're two star players of those two wingers. It was just a case of like they just played through Liverpool and sort of, you know,
tidy finish from Townsend again as well.
I mean, he's got some big game mojo going on this season, hasn't he? What's this? He downed
City. Chelsea City.
Yeah, and now almost took down Liverpool, Anfield. You're like, wow, okay, fair enough, mate. I mean, Palace are a really interesting side because as much as I do agree with Will, the first goal wasn't exactly a counter, but I find them really intriguing because they are sort of perfectly set up. It's obviously their manager is Roy Hodgson, who is great at this anyway, but like they're very defensively drilled, and they can obviously with Zaha and Townsend, they can counter-attack at pace, and it's they're just really interesting to watch. And I think they're one of those little teams. They're not going to finish like top seven or something, because the way they're set up, they find it hard to consistently beat weaker sides around their level and weaker sides. But I think they're one of those sides. They'll always give the top six a game when they play them. And I think that you need the kind of sides like that in the league, you know, like Celta Vigo, that sort of thing. Yeah, sides that are just going to be a pain in the backside whenever they play.
So yeah. I would say one tactical trend that Liverpool didn't entirely abandon and revert back to last season, because as Mo says, like Palace are a very well defensively drilled side, and you might have seen previous Liverpool teams sort of come unstuck and fail to score at all against them. But it does look like Liverpool are liking that long diagonal ball from like Fabinho or a centre back to the marauding fullback. That seems to be their preferred method of breaking down low block defences.
Yeah, switching the path. Speaking of courage and convictions, by the way, Liverpool, great example. You know, they Klopp's got them drilled, and they you can't scare them into doing what they don't want to do. And that the Palace game was almost a great example, because they got, like Will says, they got completely shook up. Like, oh my God, we're losing at Anfield. What the hell's going on? And, you know, they stayed cool, stayed calm, and got it done.
Totally sucks for Julian Speroni, though.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I saw some Palace fan tweet, like, they might not even have a club if it wasn't for him, because I think he's the only player to win three Player of the Season awards for them consecutively.
He's there.
He did it in the 2009-10 season, where I think they went into administration, got a 10-point deduction. So, like, that's what that Palace fan is referring to. And he wouldn't have even expected to play in this game if it wasn't for, like, the injury, the freak injury sort of crisis Palace have suffered at goalkeeping. And he's 40. Well, he's 39, but he's basically 40. His contract expires in the summer.
He's 39 until he's 40, Will.
Yeah. this could have been like his swan song. And yeah, he was. They might have won the game if it wasn't for the error for Liverpool's third, and the way he sort of found himself in no man's land for the Salah equaliser. Mm. Where if he'd stayed on his line, Salah wouldn't have been able to sort of.
Definitely a cruel finish for him. Another topic that seems to never be too far away from our podcasts is Mohamed Salah and diving. Do we think he went down a little too easily?
Yeah, but leave him alone. Let him dive, man. Everyone dives. this is such an absurd thing. Oh my God, did he dive? Who cares? It's modern football. Literally all attacking players dive because defenders are huge and hurt them repeatedly. And if they don't fall over, as there is seen many examples of, they don't get decisions.
This one was worse, I thought, than all the others. Like, all the others, there was like an incredible claim for a penalty, I would say. But this one...
Yeah, it was a bad dive.
That looked like pure manufacturing of simulation.
There's literally one... The only top player I could think of, the top attacking player that doesn't dive, is Messi. Literally every other player dives. So what is the big...
Messi likes to take a tumble.
I don't know. Suarez loves to take a tumble. But this is my point. There's just every... Literally, you can't name a top player that hasn't done it before. Messi has done it before. And like every player dives. Most players do it regularly. It's like, why do we care so much about it? It's like, okay, yes, yeah, Salah dove. Oh wow, really?
It's because it can define a game. Kind
of. So many other things can define a game.
And you've won the penalty by diving, then that deserves to be talked about.
That's fair enough. Yeah, but at the same time, like, plenty of things can win a game. You know, a player can judo throw an attacking player to the ground, and that can decide a game. You know, so it's. There are plenty of things that can decide games. Why do we get obsessed with the diving? Like it's more important or more dramatic than anything else. It was a dive. You say, yeah, mate, that was a dive, and then that's the end of it. Like if he has a habit of diving, that's because he's an attacking player, and he realizes he's not going to get decisions if he stays on his feet. Which is also that's the main thing. That's the main thing.
On the subject of refereeing decisions, I don't know if you guys saw this, but apparently John Moss, who sent off James Milner, he used to be his primary school teacher.
Yeah, unbelievable.
I used to like coach the team. I mean, I can't do this justice because it all revolves around the photo that was going on Twitter. But there's a picture of John Moss just sat
a very young John Moss.
Yeah, and then a very young James Milner, like captain his primary school team. Yeah, that was shout out for Chris Fozard. At Chris Fozard, that's his handle. I don't know if I've got his name right, but if check out his timeline to see that photo, because it is a treat.
Okay, next up we've got the number 12, which is the number of goals Marcus Rashford has been directly involved in his last 12 games for Manchester United across all competitions. So do we think he is the best fit striker in the Premier League at the moment?
Yes. I mean,
straight, simple as that.
Well, no, it is. That's the thing, isn't it? Because obviously there was clearly the best striker in the Premier League is Harry Kane, right? Aguero is not in his best moment, so the best fit striker in the Premier League is Marcus Rashford. Like, those two are the standout strikers, right? There's no one could argue with that. Those two are phenomenal, world-class players, and when fit and in form, top two by a mile. But Kane's not fit, and Aguero's not in form, so Rashford. He's playing brilliantly. This is what we've always... what we expected from him when he... Well, not expected, but when he came out of nowhere in that Van Gaal season. Mm-hmm. And, you know, two goals against Midtjylland, two goals and an assist against Arsenal in the first two games. You're thinking, okay, this kid's special. He plays brilliantly, wins the game against City later in the season. He's playing brilliantly all season. You're thinking, okay, this is a kid. This is the guy. Number nine, striker, amazing. Mourinho shows up, predictably puts him on the wing, makes him spend the entire two seasons running up and down the touchline, defending people, sucks the joy out of his game. You're thinking, oh, maybe... And everyone's like, maybe Rashford's just like Welbeck. Well, no, actually. Maybe his manager is a horrible person. Horrible coach. So, as soon as Rashford gets put up front, he starts delivering. This is not, like, a complicated equation here. He's a striker. You put him up front, play him as a striker in an attacking side... Give him confidence that, oh, if you miss a chance, you're going to get dropped. Like Rashford, when he played on the front under Mourinho, that was that miss again in the Champions League. And Mourinho turns around to the crowd and goes, oh, well, look what I have to work with, you know, making it all about himself again. Solskjaer was like, look, just go, make mistakes. You're going to keep making mistakes. Just keep making them because eventually it will start working for you. Solskjaer supported Rashford. Rashford playing up front now is flowing. He's in form. He's happy with the ball at his feet. He's comfortable making runs off the ball. He's scoring goals. I mean, the goal was sensational. It was beautiful.
Yeah, great finish. Yeah.
Wonderful skill. It's good strength to hold off the defender and then, boom, just launches it into the far corner of the net. It's a wonderful goal. He's playing wonderfully. This is what we saw in glimpses with England over the last years, and now we're going to see regularly. And now it's a problem for England. Now England are like, well, England have to play two up front now, surely, because you're looking at how good these two are together. And how good these two are and how good they could be together, because they are different styles of striker as well. That's the thing. They could be a legendary strike partnership, Kane and Rashford. But for United, Rashford is perfect. He's everything you want. He's fast. He's homegrown. Homegrown strikers are always the best, aren't they? There's something special about him. Homegrown everywhere else is great and fantastic, but it's homegrown strikers. There's something special about him. So he's a homegrown striker. He's fast. He loves the club. He's a great goal scorer. What more do you want?
Yeah, you mentioned confidence. He's definitely... He's definitely loving life under Solskjaer, who is obviously a United legend, and he's given him plenty of confidence and almost that sort of one-on-one coaching where it's, I've been there, I've done it, that's the finish you should go for. Shoot, shoot, shoot. I remember before Solskjaer took over, there was a clip that was doing the rounds on Twitter of him taking a coaching session, and he was saying to everyone, shoot, shoot, when you're in the position, shoot. And yeah. It's just great to see him playing with confidence.
He seems very durable as well, Rashford. Like, I struggle to remember any sort of serious injuries he's suffered. I mean, which is bad for Lukaku because
touch wood, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I mean, that would suggest he's not really going to get too many opportunities.
He's got the frame as well, which I think someone pointed out before, that he could put muscle on without getting too enormously bulky. Like, he's not like the Wayne Rooney frame where you can tell he's going to age horribly because it's like he'll put on weight so easily and it's very hard to get rid of it.
Which, well, I don't think he's knocking back the pints.
Well, no, he's not. But Rooney is of a body type that even if he wasn't, like, he had to really look after himself to age. For example, as well as like Ryan Giggs, because Ryan Giggs had a very slender sort of body. Mm-hmm. And Rashford is the same, so it's easier for Rashford. It's not easy, but it's still easier. And yeah, he does seem to have a very sort of strong durability. He could put on muscle if he wanted to, although frankly I don't think he should, because speed is his greatest asset. He's very, very, he's got great skill. It's not quite Martial levels of dribbling wizardry, but he's got great skill with the ball at his feet. He's got a really good change of pace. He understands how to use his pace, understands how to use his strength. I mean, like I said, the goal at the weekend, the skill was dazzling, but he held the defender off before as he took that shot. So he's obviously understanding how to use his strength. I mean, that's Lukaku's big weakness, really, is that he's an enormous, physically strong guy and he doesn't know how to use it at all.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Where does Rashford sort of rise to prominence here, leave Lukaku
on the bench? I mean, look, it's ludicrous to think that this amazing striker who is like a consistently scores goals in the Premier League, I think one of the youngest to reach 100 goals in the Premier League, just a phenomenal goal scorer, really, really great player, is on the bench, but he doesn't bring what Rashford brings to the side, and what Rashford brings is what suits the most Man United players. He's not as fast as Rashford, so he can't expand the attack vertically like Rashford can. He's not as good with the ball at his feet as Rashford. He's a better goal scorer in and around the box, but the way United play, Rashford suits them more. Like, if United had a genuinely amazing right winger and a genuinely amazing left winger in terms of being creative, like proper wingers, not wing forwards like Martial, not attacking midfield number 10s like Jesse Lingard. If they had actual wingers, Lukaku would be no-brainer the best choice, because then you're creating chances, you're sending crosses in, he's going to start hammering goals in. But if you've got like a wing forward like Martial, who's as much a striker as he is a winger, and you've got Jesse Lingard, who's basically a 10 playing out wide, Rashford is the choice, because you need someone who can do it all, who doesn't just rely on service. I mean, I said it before, you know, Lukaku is a 6'3 Javier Hernandez, and he needs the coach to play for a team that's just going to produce him chances, because he will score avalanches of goals if he's given the service, but he needs the service. Rashford can almost be his own service. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, I guess Lukaku's probably thinking, I'm probably just going to have to sit tight and see who becomes the permanent manager.
It totally depends, because you'd maybe say that there's potentially a starting spot for him in like the split striker system that Solskjaer has used a couple of times with Jesse Lingard, the number 10, or potentially even on the wing, like as was the case under while he was at Everton under Martinez and for Belgium at the World Cup. But that's about it, because nothing should come between like Rashford's development and his starting spot in this 11 right now, because the going is pretty good, and he's the popular choice there. It needed a manager with little pressure in terms of the temporary basis of Solskjaer's contract. It needed someone in that situation to be able to just take the risk on Rashford, because Lukaku is always going to be the safer option.
Yeah,
up front.
But I mean, if he's happy with it, he would absolutely. I mean, you know, United, Ferguson always had famously had four strikers. So he could easily stay at United and play a massive role for the club. Like, he wouldn't necessarily be the starter in every single game. Like, Rashford would start in the big games and so on and so forth. But he would absolutely play a huge role for United, because it's a squad game. You can't play Rashford 60 games in a season. He'll break down. So you need to rotate. You need rotations. You need to play different systems. Sometimes you're playing two up front. Sometimes you want to play someone like Lukaku up front and sending crosses and whatever, whatever. So, yeah, if he's happy to fight for his place and occasionally concede the fact that he might not always start, then he could still be magnificent for United. There's no question about that. And I mean, in terms of the modern market, 75 million, which they paid for him, which was huge at the time, is like actually now reasonable. That's like, yeah, that's about right for a player of his talent. Like, he might not even be the starter for a club of United's stature. So, if he's willing to not necessarily be the out-and-out first choice, the guy, he can stay there and be fine, because he will play plenty of games and he will score goals. As he's shown already, he's scoring goals off the bench in the first two games. So he's got a role to play. But if he wants to be the guy, as Will says, nothing should get in the way of Rashford. So
I could see my prediction on this one is PSG. I think Cavani's contract up in 2020, and he said he's not going to renew. So I reckon it's just going to be like,
yeah, I could see PSG. That. I could see that.
It's going to be another big club who's going to have the finances to sign him from Man United. I don't think Lukaku is going to accept a sort of.
No, I don't think he will.
Anything less than the star role in.
I don't think he will. I agree with you. I think he absolutely will demand a star role, and rightfully so to a degree.
I mean, not necessarily even the star role, but just the central role.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, like
it's a status thing.
Yeah, it's a status thing, and also he's too good to be a backup. Like, objectively, like if you look at him, you're like, yeah, you're brilliant. Well, you know, so I would understand if he doesn't want to be a backup or not a backup, but like a rotational option. I would understand that, but I think he could do very well in that role. But yeah, I agree. PSG could be a good shout, because I think
maybe Chelsea will re-sign him.
I mean, they need a striker, right? The only thing with PSG is, I don't know, would they want to get in the way of Neymar and Mbappe's chemistry, which is great. And it's like, and if you just make those two your focal point up front and you sign like a sort of more rudimentary number nine for when you need a number nine, maybe that allows you to be more tactically flexible and have more of a midfield. You know, I don't know. But yeah, PSG could go for him. Bayern could go for him. I don't think he'd be that prohibitively expensive. There's options. He's brilliant. He's a brilliant striker. He could walk into the vast majority of sides in the world. So it's not saying he's over. He's far from over, but Rashford is the guy. Rashford is unquestionably the number one at Man United. And I don't see that changing anytime soon.
Okay, moving to the other side of Manchester, we've got the number 100. Manchester City became the first team in Europe's top five leagues and England's top four divisions to reach a century of goals across all competitions by easing past Huddersfield. Leroy Sané was brilliant again. He's provided at least six more Premier League assists than any other player since the start of last season. So I'd like to discuss if we think he's the best under 23 player in the division.
Well, it's him or Rashford, isn't it? So it's a Manchester showdown.
Yeah, it's quite a good. It's quite a good field of sort of runners for that award this season. Well, just two, but I mean,
for the young player,
at least it's very competitive.
I think Joe Gomez would have been up there definitely with them had he not got injured.
You could maybe throw Trent into the mix.
Yeah, maybe, but I mean, Joe Gomez was the one that impressed me the most. But I mean, he's going to miss like. Solid chunk of the season through injury, so maybe
well,
not.
I think Joe Gomez is back pretty soon.
Is he? Well, I mean, hopefully, because he's a wonderful talent. But yeah, you know, you look at Rashford and Sané, it's hard to look past either of those two. They're both so good. Sané is just really special.
It's interesting because at the start of the season, his place was really in doubt, yeah, wasn't it? After the World Cup, Mendy was playing on the left, and it was like big questions of if he was even going to stay at Man City. So it's big credit to him, really, that he's played himself back
in. It's Mendy's injury that sort of allowed him to step into the team, really, because he's offering that width. And it's all to do with the fact that he is quite a refreshingly traditional winger in the sense that these days... Like most wingers tend to be inverted wingers who are sort of like half forward, half wide player. Like if you look at Chelsea's front line, you've got Hazard and Pedro, and they're both sort of goal scorers on the wings. Whereas Sane's job is all about the cutback, really.
Yeah, I mean, look,
get down that line.
He provides width.
Yeah, like you look at Sane, you look at he's one of those two players you think, yeah, you could play in the 90s. You know, that sort of thing. He'd play 4-4-2 in the 90s. Why 4-4-2? He'd be a sensation. And I think, we're talking about him and Lukaku would be a great pairing because he would just constantly get wide and provide chances for Lukaku. So, who's better, Sane or Rashford? I don't know. It's hard to tell. But I think Sane is a really special player, really creative. His resilience is impressive because obviously, like I said, he started the season terribly. Mendy had basically taken his place, and I know Mendy's injury is partially what let him in, but his performances since he's got back in have been exemplary. He's so relentlessly creative. He uses his pace brilliantly. His crossing is wonderful. He knows when to make runs, and his finish. This is the thing. His finish was really good. Like he waited and waited and waited, then just clipped it in the near post. It was beautiful. It was really good. The way he links with Sterling is wonderful. Yeah, he's just a sensational player. Really, really good to watch. You know, the only thing I can say that's a shame about him is that he wears 19 and not like 11 or something. That's literally it. That's the criticism of Leroy Sané. Wear a better shirt number. He's really quite great.
Yeah, interestingly, only Wilson and Fraser with 7 have combined for more Premier League goals this season than Sterling and Sané with 6.
That's great because that's a win combo as well. And I think also in terms of rate of assists, Sané's rate of assist is like 150. He gets an assist every 153 minutes or something like that, which is by far the best. Like the next highest is De Bruyne at 200 and something. Mm-hmm. So he's got the most assists since the start of 2017. Since the start of 2017-18, sorry, which is 23 or something. And he's got the most rate of assist as well. Yeah. So he does it in the...
If Guardiola didn't rotate so much, you'd say that's like... Man City's wing position is just locked down for like 10 years given their ages. It's like Bayern levels of consistent top class wingers like a la Ribery and Robin essentially.
Music to Riyad Mahrez's ears, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Did you see Guardiola afterwards? He was like, was there any reason Mahrez didn't play? He goes, no. Just like,
and he was actually in the team when playing, I think, on the left when Mendy was there because he's more of a, like I said, a sort of forward winger.
When Mendy was there, it was Mahrez and Sterling saw more action because Sterling could play on the left, Mahrez could play on the left. They could cut in field when Mendy went out around the outside. But I think this is City's more natural state. And I think also playing Mendy, it puts way too much defensive pressure on Fernandinho. I think what City need to do, what they should have done, is they should be in the market for a left-back because... Danilo scored, obviously, but it was heavily deflected, and he played okay, but he's not a left-back. The best teams in the world will hurt them if they go into there with a makeshift left-back. Liverpool have already done it. They'll do it again. It's just Leon killed Fabian Delph in the Champions League. Like, They will get hurt if they go into. They need to. I can't believe. I mean, defensive midfield. At least you could argue they have enough players in there that they could sort of maybe get by without Fernandinho. Sort of make a good fist of it in weaker games without Fernandinho, and then bring him in for big games. There's no left back option. Mendy is an injury. It's sad to see because he's a phenomenal player, but he's an injury nightmare. Mm. They need to sign a left back. I'm genuinely perplexed they haven't gone for one.
I mean, it's only. It's the only real sort of chink in their squad's armour, isn't it?
Well, they have the two. There's no replacement for Fernandinho and there's no left back, basically, Mendy isn't fit. And Mendy's never fit, so it's a real issue. Yeah. It's more pressing, I think, than the defensive midfield, although they need to address that in. But actually, it's funny, isn't it? Their two targets for defensive midfield were Jorginho and Fred, and they both went elsewhere. And neither of them are playing well right now.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, City, they're like...
Yeah, dodged a bullet. Also, Alexis Sanchez, they missed out on in January, so they seems to be dodging transfer bullets left, right and centre.
Yeah, they got lucky. They got lucky a few times. But yeah, Sterling and Sane, wonderful combination. It's good to see wingers linking like that as well, because obviously, you know, again, it's very old school. It's very sort of 90s kind of football. Like you could put them in a 4-4-2 with two strikers up front. I mean, Pep wouldn't do that, but you could do that, and they'd be wonderful. They'd be really, really good to watch.
Yeah. So we touched on squad depth there, and our next number is 1,764, which is the number of days since Spurs had last won a Premier League game without Harry Kane or Son Heung-min, despite Fernando Llorente's best efforts. All the talk was about whether they could cope without their main men, and they did just about. But obviously now Dele Alli is injured as well. So what kind of impact is Dele's injury going to have without three of their main men?
It's huge in a symbolic sense, because just over a month ago we were talking about how much of a game changer it was for Spurs to have that four-man sort of attack of Son, Eriksen, Kane and Alli all firing,
yeah.
And fit. I think they all scored in the same game for the first time in the 6-2 win over Everton, which sort of propelled Spurs into the title race to an extent. They've since obviously dropped off. Mm-hmm. And like I said, that was just over a month ago. And now they're missing three of those players. Pochettino, for his part, is saying, like, it's not a concern. It's an opportunity for other players to step up, as any manager, I mean, should be saying in this situation, because you don't want to create that sense of panic.
He does like that line, Pochettino.
Yeah. And he's also invoked Lionel Messi's false nine era when he was discussing how they can replace Harry Kane with a sort of attacker in that sort of central position. The ideal candidate for that, though, would have been probably Dele Alli.
Mm.
And it looked like a bad one, the way he was clutching his hamstring. Could be like 4 to 6 weeks.
I mean, you could put Eriksen as a false nine.
Yeah,
the thing is...
Yeah, he named four players as well. So there's, I think, that Kaziah Sterling was one. Troy Parrott... was spoken about.
The thing is,
Eric Lamella is a good option.
The thing is, with the false nine, right? Even if you play Eriksen there and he's wonderful, or whoever there, you need what made the false nine work. What makes it work is you have wingers that run in behind and do loads of damage. And like Spurs' best guys to do that is Son, and he's not there. So it's like, you're relying on what, Nkudu and Lamella to run in behind. I mean,
they've got Lucas Moura as well. I think he's going to maybe be back.
Well, if he's back, then maybe that could work. That could work. But that's something you have to practice. Like, because without runners in behind, all you get is like Spain 2012, except you need to have the best midfielders in the world for Spain 2012, and Spurs don't have that. So like, it's a troubling look. It's an idea. It's definitely something they could look at, and they probably will have to, because I think Daniel Levy's not going to sanction a signing in January.
I do think, though, an attack of like Eriksen, and maybe as a sort of number 10 and a sort of split forward duo of Lucas Moura and Eric Lamella is not too bad.
It could work. It would.
That's what I mean. This is exposed, I think, potentially, that Spurs squad depth isn't as terrible as a lot of people make out, because that's a good backup.
It's good, but it's also injury prone and unreliable. The reason Spurs embraced a diamond, obviously, to win at Old Trafford, and it was a big win. That was ages ago, but they didn't really pick up steam with the formation until they replaced Lucas with Son in it, because Lucas is not as consistent a performer as Son is, and he's not as good a player. And so, look, there's definitely potential for them to work the diamond formation, you know, that they have been doing, but with just a few rejig personnel. But they're going to miss Dele Alli, because Dele Alli added a lot of verticality and thrust to that system with his runs, with his movement of the ball, his goal scoring. I mean, they didn't look like they were going to pull a goal out of anywhere against Fulham. And then they pulled out the Dele, you know, the classic, the cutback to the guy on the edge of the box, he clips in across to the far post, deadly nods it in. You know, England have used it, Spurs have used it before. It was England against Sweden, they scored, Jesse Lingard crossed it for him. Obviously against Chelsea, they destroyed Azpilicueta in the back three back in 2017 now, I think it was. So, you know, that's the move they used to break them down. And then the other goal was just a hopeful hoik into the box that they got sort of lucky that Joe Bryan just wasn't paying attention at defence and let Harry Winks run in off him. So, you know, there's obviously time. You know, they've got time to work on it and work on training, you know, and work on the false line and make it something functional, work on the diamond or whatever it is. But I still think they need to sign someone, man. Their squad is always... It's obviously they've got a bit more depth in the attacking midfield area, but their goal scoring depth is non-existent behind Harry Kane. Like, because Son is a starter and Dele is a starter, so they don't have anyone who can come in and be consistently or even semi-consistently be relied upon to score goals. Like, you know, you look at the other top four teams. You know, Aguero goes down, you can bring in Jesus. Liverpool, you've got that front three. You've got Shaqiri. So if one of the front three goes down, you plug Shaqiri in there, you find Sturridge. Even at the worst case scenario, is semi-reliable. Mm. You know, Chelsea don't have a goal scorer to speak of. That's why they're dropping out of the race. Man United, no Rashford. You bring in the big man Lukaku. So, and you know, everyone else has options. Arsenal got Aubameyang, Lacazette. They can bring in, you know, it will be in push up one of the Aubameyang and Lacazette up front. There's options. There's no option for Spurs beyond what they've got, which is now not there because they're injured and on international duty. So, I mean, it's this is why I thought they would drop out of the top four. I thought there's only so many miracles Pochettino can do. Look. Who are we to doubt him? He could very well make this false nine work. He's performed wonders to get them this far on a tiny squad paying 2005 wages. You know, so yeah, if anyone could do it, it's him, but I just don't see him doing it.
Well, someone else who's emerged as an option, albeit not a goal-scoring option, is George Kevin Nkudu. Do we think he can do a Moussa Sissoko and actually come good at Spurs? It's a big ask.
It's also like, what do you base that on? Just like one kick. I was looking at the Opta feeds. And per 90 minutes, Nkudu's on like 22.5 chances created. Because of, obviously, that's not how it works. He's only created one chance, but he's done it in a 5-minute, whatever, however many minutes he played at the weekend. There's just nothing to base it on. I think they've got better options to play an attack, as I've just sort of gone through previously. And I would maybe stick with Llorente if you just want to play a classic number nine. Because as far as backup options go, he's nowhere near Kane, of course, but it's not a bad backup striker.
He just took a shot of confidence.
That would have done him no favours whatsoever, that own goal.
It's so bad. He just looks...
He just
looks shot of confidence, Llorente, which is like, I mean, it goes to show spending like, what, a year and a half, 2 years sitting on the bench is probably not the best idea for your career. It's just hard to find a backup striker when your starting striker plays all the time.
Yeah, because I mean, he's tried to fill it with the right sort of you either go for someone who's young and unproven, or someone is proven but is willing to take a reduced role. But then they both come with their huge disadvantages.
It's also the fact that he doesn't use them like anywhere near enough. Like, I know that Kane is your guy, but he rides Kane into the ground every year, and it's like you should maybe just rotate him every now and again. Like, I get it, he wants to play every game. He's Harry Kane, wants to score all the goals in the world. That's great. That's fantastic. Maybe just every fourth game, just give him a rest. You know, not necessarily, don't just wait for the cups, which you don't care about, to play Llorente. He gives Llorente or NG or whoever it is like one or two games a season, because he doesn't care about any of the cups. So, you know, maybe just rest Harry Kane for league games sometimes, you know, and keep him healthy. And that, and not only does that keep him fresher, it keeps your backup strikers in a sort of rhythm. Like, Llorente looks like a guy who hasn't played regular football for like, I don't know, a year, 2 years.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. I mean, they've got the League Cup this coming week against Chelsea now, and I mean, that's two sides on a low ebb, man. I mean, Spurs will have the good morale after the win, but they did not play well against Fulham. Fulham are a bad team, and they only just about scraped away with that win.
Yeah, well, I thought Fulham did play well though to restrict Spurs.
Ryan Barbell was a
he looks he there's he hustled a lot, and he was working really hard, which is what you want in one sense if you're a team battling relegation. But he also wasn't very clinical in failing to take that early chance. And Fulham already have a forward who puts himself about but isn't very clinical in Mitrovic. So I don't know if it does bode necessarily as well as
I like what he brought. I like what he brought.
It's true, but I just needed someone just to take.
Yeah, but he's also not very fit. Like he went off after what 55 minutes, 60 minutes because he clearly was not match fit. But I think the movement that was really bright, and I thought that the intention and the ability to carry the ball forward was really good because Schürrle's a good finisher, but he's not like a dribbler or anything like that. And Mitrovic obviously is a good, well, inconsistent, but very potent finisher on his day, but isn't the guy to carry the ball at the field. Really, I mean, what he's doing is what Sessegnon is still a bit too young to do, which is taking the ball, carrying it past defenders, dragging Fulham up the field. And he did that numerous times against Spurs. And if he was just a bit sharper in terms of his rhythm, I think he would have bagged at least one goal, maybe even two, after that amazing Callum Chambers back heel to put him through 1v1.
Yes, oh my God, that was.
I mean, Chambers went turned to the Petersfield Pirlo, man. You know, it was like, yeah. I'm playing Spurs, I've got to do Arsenal proud. You know, he was brilliant. But it was, you know, the potential for Barber. I mean, look, let's see it. That was one game. Let's see how he builds on it. But I think there's a potential there that Barber could really help them. I'm not saying it will be enough to save them because they have a lot of issues, but it could be a good help.
So, loads to talk about in the Premier League this week. But we've also got to talk about transfers, being that it's that time of the year. With deadline day fast approaching. So first up, we've got Higuain's proposed move to Chelsea, which seems to be the deal that everyone knows about but isn't quite over the line. Do we think he's the right man for Chelsea, or does it reek of desperation that they're going for an ageing Higuain?
He's 31 years old and he hasn't had the best of seasons. He's a bit desperate. But at the same time, he does know how to run in behind, he doesn't know how to play with Mauricio Sarri, and he does know how to score goals. So, okay. Like, he's not the kind of guy for knockout cup football, just as an FYI to Chelsea fans, but he's fantastic in league play. Like, he may bottle some chances in cup games, especially finals, if you get there.
He's got a bit of the Benzema about him in terms of, like,
but like
unselfish.
Very, very high. Yeah, it all depends on how he settles in England, because he could easily do a Shevchenko and just be absolutely atrocious and not get it, not get the country, not get the lifestyle, all that sort of thing. But, you know, look, he likes to eat. London's got great food. You know, London's got some great food places to eat. You know, go to North London, get some Turkish food, fantastic stuff. But he's a great goal scorer. He has been, basically since he was 18 years old, he's been a great goal scorer in big games, in league play, consistent goal scorer. Even this season so far, I think he's almost got a 1-2 ratio for a very dodgy Milan side. I think if you put him in between Eden Hazard and Pedro, that's really good. That's potentially really, really good, because Hazard is obviously a phenomenal dribbler, will create chances for himself, but also for others. And part of the issue with Giroud, with Morata, is that they don't necessarily make killer goal scorer movements to get the ball in killer goal scoring positions. Hazard could flash a ball across the face of goal. Is Giroud going to show up and tap it in? Maybe, maybe not, because maybe he's at the top of the box, having to flick the ball through for Hazard. Whereas Morata, he's probably standing somewhere over there thinking about what his haircut is. You know, Giroud, Higuain is going to make that run and he's going to tap that ball in, you know. So he potentially, how he adapts to England is obviously going to be the deciding factor, because he's 31 and he's not in the best of shape and everything. But if he adapts to England, I think he could be really, really good for Chelsea, because they desperately need someone to be at the sharp end.
But that's
what attacks.
I think it boils down to, is the sort of speed that he's going to take to life at Chelsea, because they need him to make an immediate impact. They clearly can't carry on playing with the false nine. Well, if he doesn't come in and hit the ground running, then he's going to be up against it.
He's played with Sarri before at Napoli. I mean, it would be nice if Sarri didn't restrict himself to only signing players he's previously coached, because they'll eventually run out.
Yeah, but then
there's only so many of those you can sign.
But then I think, as you know, he's banging on about it.
Yeah, I think that's the reason they're going for him rather than maybe a Callum Wilson type, because when you're making a signing midway through the season, you don't get that pre-season training sessions you can help them tactically adapt.
Yeah, Higuain knows the system already. He'll come in. I mean, he was obviously it was 3 years ago, but he had his most amazing season, broke the Serie A goal scoring record playing under Sarri. So he knows the system, knows what to do in it. That's very important. If he can adapt, it's all about if he can adapt.
He's on big wages though as well, reportedly 270 grand, which would put him right up there among the sort of.
But
it is
a loan though, isn't it? That's what I thought.
So it's a loan with I think it's like there was an £18 million loan fee or something that Juventus would due. So maybe Chelsea will have to pay half of that. I don't know how it's going to work.
Maybe.
It's a really, really complicated signing. And there's also the clause, the €36 million fee that is required to sign him permanently in the summer. So it's maybe risk-free, depending on whether, I mean, that becomes an obligation to purchase or something based on like the amount of appearances that he makes, which might trigger an obligation to purchase or something like that. I'm speculating here, but
yeah,
I mean, Chelsea don't want to end up with a 31-year-old striker on
£270k, yeah,
who's not scoring like.
They could end up with, at the end of the season, they've got Morata, Giroud.
I think Morata
and Higuain on their books.
Yeah, Morata's probably going to be going to Atletico Madrid though, as part of this whole sort of transfer striker merry-go-round. Chelsea seem to involve themselves on a yearly basis.
Yeah. Another team on the merry-go-round is West Ham. They've been linked with Celta Vigo's Maxi Gomez. Mo, can you tell us a bit about him?
Yeah, he's really, really good. That's amazing for what, because obviously he's been linked with Barcelona. That's the club that everyone's talking about he's going to go to. So if West Ham can get in on that action, that's a real coup for them. He's very, very muscular striker. Loves the he's a good goal scorer, consistent goal scorer. Not like super duper prolific yet, but he's also playing for Celta Vigo, who aren't super duper creative or anything. Scores against big teams, like scored against Real Madrid, scored against Barcelona, scored against Atletico Madrid. You know, has a decent amount of pace, not blisteringly quick, but he's very strong, very good in the air, very physical. He's a Uruguayan striker, so he's that's kind of what you expect. You know, he's got not quite as much hocus pocus as Luis Suarez, but a bit more power about him. He could fit into the Premier League very well. He wouldn't be overawed by the physicality of it at all. If West Ham can get into that, he's got a $50 million buyout clause, right? So if West Ham can get in on that action before, I mean, he's one of the top names on Barca's shortlist. Like it's Harry Kane, then it's him. So if West Ham can get in on that action, that's huge for them. He potentially could do brilliantly for them as well. Obviously, you know, you always have to be a bit wary of West Ham because it's like, will they play with consistency? But under Pellegrini, I think they're improving. So I think. I mean, they need a goal scorer, right? They need a striker. They need a consistent presence up there. I think Maxi Gomez could absolutely be that guy. If they can get him, nip in and get him. Celta have said they don't want to sell to the end of the season, but ultimately he does have a clause, so
yeah, he
could just activate it.
And obviously, Marko Arnautović is still a West Ham player, despite being left out of the team at Bournemouth, sorry. So what do we think about that situation? Are West Ham crazy not to sell for the price that they've been given?
Yeah,
or should
depends.
They be respected for...
There's reports now emerging that they expect him to stay. If Shanghai SIPG and Guangzhou Evergrande, I think, are the two teams mentioned, if they don't go near the 50 million valuation enough to sign him, then West Ham reportedly aren't going to sell. I mean, whether that's the right choice for them, it depends on what the situation looks like behind the scenes. If they think that he can be brought back into the changing room and is going to contribute to the rest of the season, because he might not be very happy with in being denied the sort of the chance to earn the type of money on offer in China, and that might create another Dimitri Payet situation, which, I mean,
it could derail West Ham's whole season, couldn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. But if it looks like he can be sort of, I mean, they'll probably have to sit down and discuss terms over a new deal with him to keep him happy immediately after this saga. I think he's reportedly on like $100,000 a week. The only player earning more is Javier Hernandez on 140, and he's a sort of cautionary tale for West Ham in how it could go wrong if they do sell and try and invest in someone like Maxi Gomez, because they've got other examples of players at the club who have disappointed in terms of if you've got Perez as well, and I think if you can keep Arnautović happy, then play it safe, keep him, because he's.
I would
he's
argue
talismanic in terms of his dressing room.
I would argue you sell him for as much as you can get, not necessarily like if it's like they were only pay 40 million.
It's a gamble though, and
it's a gamble.
It's,
but I mean,
it's
to
an
me,
unnecessary gamble.
You look at Hernandez, you look at Arnautović, you look at Lucas Perez. These guys are all. Post 26, 27, they're all veterans. Maxi Gomez is 23 years old. You can bring him in. You can help use him to help create your new club culture that you've got Felipe Anderson. You've got a whole Declan Rice. You've got a whole young core of this side. You're building a new team, a new era at West Ham. I think Maxi Gomez could absolutely be a big part of that. Whereas, like, you know, you look at these older guys. I mean, look, Arnautović has been brilliant for West Ham since David Moyes went there.
He's the only striker signing they've really got right in... years.
Yeah, but that's because he's performed. Like, he's so mercurial. Like, he could literally just stop performing. Like, that. He's so inconsistent. He always has been. Like, he's playing well now. This is what I'm saying. With the players like Arnautovic, I think you take the money and run.
Yeah,
like,
I think they should
He's so inconsistent. Like, he could just stop. I mean, not even... Even if they bring him back and forward and give him the contract he wants, he could just stop playing. Well, he's that kind of inconsistent player and always has been in his career. If they've managed to help him catch fire, as they have done, then and now someone wants to buy him for like 40 million quid or something, you take that money and you say, yeah, go on, take him. Because he won't play this well again for a stretch of time that he has done. He won't do this again. And right now, yeah, he's their main option. But if you sell him and you sign Maxi Gomez, for instance, he won't be on the wages and that, which is on, not 100K. He won't, and he's young, and he'll be part of your new young West Ham, and no longer signing overhyped veterans for like massive wages, and just that not having any idea how to fit them into the side. You know, Declan Rice, Felipe Anderson, you know, and then Maxi Gomez. There's a pattern emerging there of young talents being given their chance, and you know, and making a new side, making West Ham into something different.
Mm. I guess their fear is sourcing that what they see as the right replacement. For right now.
Yeah. I mean, I guess Maxi Gomez does represent a sort of deviation from, as you say, these sort of like overhyped veterans they seem to have signed up front for recent seasons, like Javier Hernandez, Lucas Perez.
And also, usually they might sort of balk at the 50 million release clause, but if you get 40 million in the bank from Arnautovic, then it turns into a £10 million punt on Maxi Gomez instead of like a massive outlay. So finally, this hasn't been a vintage transfer window yet so far. Not too many deals being done. Why do we think there is a sort of lack of business? Obviously, we're still sort of a week away before it really ramps up. But do we think Premier League clubs have sort of learned their lessons and the market is too difficult at this time of year?
I think what we got last year was abnormal because we had a lot of unfinished business from the summer. There was Coutinho, there was Van Dijk, these were Alexis Sanchez. These were big deals that should have gone ahead in the summer. And because some clubs, selling clubs, were obstinate, were like, no, we're not selling them, it sort of got carried over. You know, no, Liverpool didn't want to sell Coutinho in the summer. They're like, no, we're not selling him, go away. You know, Southampton were like, we're not selling you Van Dijk, leave us alone. You know, but buying clubs don't give up that easily. Southampton were like, you're our feeder club. Liverpool were like, you're our feeder club, Southampton, give us your player. Barcelona were like, you're our feeder club, Liverpool, give us our player. And they went back for them in January and they got their men. And resulted in huge, enormous deals in January. But I think that's abnormal. I think what is normal is you get one club is like in a bit of trouble and jumps into the market heavily, Chelsea have. And then other clubs are like, well, if we can see a deal, we'll take a chance. But otherwise, we're not really going to push the boat. Real Madrid need to go and sign somebody, right? They've not been... They signed Brahim Diaz from City. That's it. They need to sign a striker. Are they signing a striker? No. You know, Barca need a backup striker. They're like, well, we'll sign one. But they keep... Their shortlist just keeps... Oh, no, not him, not him, not him. So it's like, who then? So, you know, clubs are reluctant to jump into the market in January because you never know what you're going to get. And obviously, yeah, no preseason. That's always a risk.
Mm.
Last season was abnormal. It was great fun for us. But what it was essentially cleaning up unfinished business from the summer where clubs are just... Although the weird thing is, of course, with the new UEFA now ending the cup tie rule in Champions League, you'd think that would mean more business in January. Yeah. But strangely enough, it hasn't. But, I mean, you'd think maybe in time it will adapt to mean that January actually becomes a valid transfer window now.
Mm.
Because right now, I mean, for the top clubs, it's not really. It's just sort of staging posts where we just get annoyed by rumours for a month.
Yeah, interestingly, in the Premier League as well, some of the sort of teams who are in trouble at the wrong end of the league haven't sort of gone for broke yet. Okay, Cardiff.
You always expect like a sort of striker signing.
Yeah, someone sort of do or die.
Score your way out of relegation, yeah.
We're in trouble, we need to make a sign in to sort of, this is the last ditch, and we haven't quite seen any of that yet. But obviously a long way to go.
Yeah. And Higuain would be big. And you can't forget that Chelsea have also paid like 60 million or however much it was for Pulisic in this winter.
True. Very easy to forget, yeah.
Well, it's purely because it's one of those annoying ones where they have to spend the rest of the season on loan at the club, so it's kind of anticlimactic.
Yeah.
I think overall, it's just managers hate the January transfer window because of Osmosis' lack of pre-season.
It would be funny if we got another big Coutinho move, though, like 1 year after his last one. It won't happen, I don't think. I mean, Barcelona need him in terms of depth and options for the squad, especially now that Dembele's injured. Who knows how long he's out for? Probably not too long, but... But yeah, it would be funny because obviously he's been linked with, I've seen Chelsea, I've seen Man United, Liverpool as well. I don't think any of them are going to happen, but I think it would be quite funny if we got another big move and it was him again.
Definitely. Okay, that's all we've got time for today. Thanks to Mo for coming on.
Thanks for having me, mate. Been a pleasure.
And thank you to Will.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Most importantly, thanks to all of you for listening. We'll catch you next time.